We're going to continue a series we've been in for about the last week now, but it's going to last about 6 weeks, called Everybody Hurts. And the premise of this series, if you were with us last week, is, and if you weren't, we'll try to recap a little. The premise of the series is basically that everybody in this life gets hurt. Nobody's exempt. Nobody gets out of life without experiencing pain. We all will leave this life with a bunch of scars. And the real question we have to wrestle with is, what do we do with our hurt? What do we do with our pain? What do we do with the stuff that happens to us that maybe because of decisions we've made, maybe because of decisions other people have made? And really, all hurt is hurt. So what do we do with the stuff that gets dropped in our lap? And how do we maybe figure out how to process it so that, you know, our lives aren't defined by that mistake or what that person did or what that person said? And last week, we basically talked about the idea that one of the struggles with the pain and hurt we have are that it feels like we don't have any choices. When we hurt, we feel like my choices have been taken away. I have no options now. All I can do is hurt. But what we discovered was that actually, no matter what's happened to you, no matter what your life has been like, you always have a choice. And the choice in our hurt and pain, we may not get to choose how it happens or who does it. We may not get to choose any of that. But what we do get to choose is we get to choose how we respond. And so last week we talked about the fact that our response to our hurt can be destructive, which means we can go down a path of destroying our life, destroying somebody else's, making poor decisions, trying to pass the hurt we've been given around to other people. We can make that choice, or we can choose something constructive. We can choose to try to do good. We talked about what happens when people who've experienced great pain and tragedy go and try to work on behalf of others so that others don't go through what they've been through and those sorts of things. So you can do something destructive or constructive. Then we talked about you can do something, you can be open or closed. You can be open to what God might be able to do in the midst of this, or you can be closed off. You can be open to the fact that even in this pain or even in this suffering or even in this grief, that even though God doesn't cause those sorts of things, that God can still work through those things. We looked at a passage in John 9 where Jesus says to his disciples, you know, don't so much focus on the question of why. It's about a man who was born blind. Don't so much ask why he was born blind, but he is blind. So let's ask what God can do in spite of his blindness. And so we basically last week talked about choices. This week, I want to continue talking about kind of laying some groundwork for how we handle our hurt, because everything that happens to us, and we mentioned this last week too, everything shapes us in some way, for the better or for the worse. It shapes us into more of the people we've been made to be, or it shapes us into less the people we've been made to be. And so today, if you have a Bible, turn to Luke chapter 7. We'll start there. I'm going to have it on the screen as well. And let me have a word of prayer, and we'll get rolling. God, we're grateful for hope, which some of us in this room, some of my brothers and sisters, may be hanging onto hope by a thread, but it's still hope. So it's my prayer, Father, that our hope would be strengthened today, that you would give us vision and perception of where you're at work and what you're doing, that you'll remind us that we're not alone. And not only not alone because we have you, but we're not alone because we have each other. And this is how you've made us to live the best life possible. It's not in isolation from others, but with others. And so as we're here in this room together, as we open up this text, as we've been lifting our voices, just our prayer that you'll speak, challenge us. For those of us who need embrace and comfort, we'll receive that. And for those of us maybe who need to be challenged, that we'll receive that as well. We love you. We pray in Jesus' name. And everybody said, amen. Everybody gets hurt. The real question is, what do you do with it? What do you do with your pain? What do you do with your grief? And so I want to look at this story in Luke 7. Jesus has been invited to a meal. When one of the Pharisees, and Pharisees were the religious leaders of the day, when one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who had lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, so she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. Now, if this were to happen at a dinner party you were hosting, how weird would you think this would be? When you have Jesus come to your house, you're throwing a dinner party, and all of a sudden this woman who wasn't invited, she's not on the guest list, she shows up. And not only does she show up, but she just starts crying uncontrollably, and she uses her tears to wash Jesus' feet, and then she dries them with her hair, and then she starts putting perfume all over his feet. This is a bit of a weird story. For us, it's a weird story because it's culturally distant from us. If you invited me to dinner at your house, I would prefer you not try to wash my feet, because I think that would get weird. You know, I'd prefer you not to do that. In Jesus' culture, it was kind of a custom that we'll see a bit more in a second. And so this woman comes in, and she does this, she performs this act, this ritual of adoration toward Jesus. Now this, for the first audience, what was controversial was not the washing of feet. What was controversial is that this even happened the way it happened. So I would say first we begin with the fact that there's a woman in the room. And in Judaism, women were not afforded, in Jesus' day, a very high place. They weren't allowed to really eat with men. They weren't allowed. If you were a Jewish woman and you were out in the community and you ran into somebody your family knew, and it was a man, and you spoke to him, your husband then could divorce you because it just didn't look right. Maybe there's something going on there. And so your husband could actually divorce you for speaking to another man in public. So women were not afforded a place of prestige and honor. They were essentially, you go fix the food, you bring it to us, and then you go eat somewhere else. It was very much a male-dominated society. And then two, this woman, we're told by the author here, Luke, that she had lived a sinful life. Now, I put sinful in quotations because for us, that invites all sorts of speculation about what she might have been up to, right? I mean, when somebody tells you, you know, so-and-so, they're just sinful. I mean, you automatically probably start going, I wonder what they're up to. I wonder what kind of sins they're, you know. But this has a very common meaning in Jesus' day. The word sinful, like I put in quotations, essentially means somebody who's ritually impure. Now, but this could take on a number of different manifestations, right? So this woman could have been ritually impure because she'd have come in contact with a dead body, because in Judaism, that made you ritually impure. But that's probably not what happened here. This idea of purity centered around the temple, and if you wanted to go worship God in God's house, you had to then be ritually pure. So you had to take careful care of your body and of your surroundings and make sure nothing impure or unclean entered your body or that you didn't come in contact with it, because when you did, you were out. You could no longer worship God in the official place, in the official capacity, in the official way. So a sinner would have been somebody who was ritually impure. We don't really know, but I think often it gets assumed that this woman was probably involved in some sort of prostitution. There's similar stories like this in the other Gospels, and it's kind of leads you to believe, kind of, you know, teases you to believe that maybe she was sexually promiscuous or something like that. But, you know, she doesn't let that stop her. I mean, she understands the risk. She's not culturally aloof. She gets the risk. When you enter the room of the home of a religious leader and you're uninvited and you're a woman and you have all this baggage and all these things that they believe keeps you on the outside looking in, you're taking your very life in your hands. I mean, very easily, this could have gone really south really fast. This woman could have been executed for not knowing her place, as they would put it. This woman, she really is taking a big risk. She comes in, regardless of cultural norms and cultural customs, she comes in and she performs this great act of love and adoration for Jesus. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Well, you know, if Jesus was legit, then he would have a sense for who she is. And he would never let her come in contact, because when an unclean person came in contact with a clean person, guess what happened? The unclean person rubbed off on the clean person. It's transmitted. My filth would be transmitted to you. So this is why I didn't shake anybody's hand this morning, right? Because I don't want you guys waking up at 2 a.m. and not being happy with me. Because when we're sick, our germs go to other people. And just think of uncleanness here in this context like a germ. If she touches Jesus, now Jesus, who is a religious figure, who goes to the temple to worship most likely, this Jesus is now what? Unclean. Her filth transmits to Jesus in this worldview. If he knew who this woman was, he would know that when she is touching him, that he's becoming like her. Filthy, not good enough, doesn't measure up. Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. And by the way, if you're ever at a dinner party with Jesus and he says this to you, you're in trouble. You just write this down. If you are at a dinner party and you've been thinking bad thoughts, Jesus is going to call you on it. "So I have something to tell you. Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii. A denarius was a day's wage. So this is a lot of money, more than a year's income. The other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now, which one of them will love him more?" So anybody want to take a guess? Who's going to love him more, the one who had 500 forgiven or 50? Yeah, 500, right? Because 500 is harder to pay back than 50. I mean, you know, so he can maybe scrounge up enough to pay back some of the 50, but 500, that's huge. And Jesus says, all right, Simon, two people, they borrowed money from the same person. Both of them spent the money, and neither one of them could afford to pay them back. And what this moneylender does is he just looks at both of them and sees their situations, and in compassion, he cancels the debt of both of them. Which one will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven. You have judged correctly, Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? This has become one of the most powerful passages in all the Bible for me. This one phrase, do you see this woman? Which implies to me that Simon has been talking about her, but not to her. That Simon has been oblivious to the fact that she's a person, right? Do you see this woman? For Simon, she was a nuisance. She was a religious outcast. She was on the outside looking in. She was part of the problem. She just needed to get right with God and move on with it. She was not good enough. And what Jesus does in this moment is so powerful because he calls attention to her humanity. I think one of the things Christians have gotten really good at, and it's a shame that we've gotten really good at it, it's we write whole groups of people off. Groups of people we don't know, groups of people we haven't come in contact with, groups of people who we've never really even built any sort of bridges with. We just write them off, and we turn people into issues. Are you with me? People, real flesh and blood human beings that God loves and made in his image, cease to be real flesh and blood, and they become issues to be debated, issues to be condemned. They just become nameless, faceless issues. Which is why when you're in moments of serious conflict, we think about where we're at in the world right now. There's conflicts all over the place. And I think there's this tendency for people just to say, let's kill them all and let God sort them out. The issue with that is those are people God loves too. And he asked Simon, do you see her? Not are you aware of her? Have you ever looked in her eyes? I mean, let's just say that our hunch is right. Let's say this woman is some sort of prostitute. Let's just say she's a prostitute. Do you think when she was a little girl, if she was asked, you know, what do we always ask kids? What do you want to be when you grow up? When I was a kid, I wanted to be a shortstop for the Atlanta Braves. That did not work out. What do you want to be when you grow up? Do you think that she would have replied, you know what I really want to be when I grow up? I want to be a prostitute. No. Actually, in this world, one of the reasons women turned to prostitutes, to become prostitutes, was likely because A, they'd never married and their father had died, so no one was left to provide for them. Or B, her husband had died and maybe her father wasn't around or no brothers, and she essentially is trying to provide for her and maybe her kids on her own. I don't think this was the life she wanted. I think she'd probably been through a lot of stuff that had brought her to this point. She had to make a lot of difficult decisions that hadn't been easy for her. And Jesus asked Simon, do you see her? Which I think is an invitation to say, do you see her pain? Do you know her story? Do you know what she's been through? Do you know what it's like, you religious Pharisee who sits on the inside and tells everybody else they're out? Do you know what it's like to be on the outside looking in? Do you know what it's like to be shunned by the community? Do you know what it's like to be embarrassed? And maybe she made choices that led her to this, and maybe some other people made choices that led her to this, but it really doesn't matter at this point because she is sitting at Jesus' feet, weeping and trying her best to get rid of this pain she's been carrying around, these mistakes that she's lagged around, this stuff that's happened to her that has formed her journey in a very specific direction. Jesus says to Simon, do you see her? Or is she just another one of those people? Is she another one of them that you feel like it's your job to just kick to the curb? Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. It was very common when you would invite someone. I mean, they're wearing sandals, dusty streets, you know, sweaty. You have nastiness caked on your feet. And so it was common to have a servant or at least have some water available for people coming into your home to wash their feet. And Jesus says, Simon, when I came to your house, your honored guest, you didn't give me any water for my feet. This woman, she came in, and since I've been here, she's been crying, wetting my feet with her tears and wiping them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. Again, in the New Testament, it says, greet one another with a holy kiss. And thankfully, that's one of those things we've said, that's a cultural thing. We're not going to keep up. But this is cultural, right? When you would enter, it was like a way of saying, peace be with you, giving a kiss on the cheek when they would come in the door. Maybe Simon doesn't do this, but she's been kissing Jesus' feet. You did not put oil on my head. She has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little, loves little. Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. The other guests began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sin? Jesus said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. What an interesting story. Jesus tells a story about a moneylender, two people who owed lots and lots of money. They both get forgiven. And Jesus says, oh yeah, it's the one who's been given forgiven the most who's going to love the most. And what is Jesus is setting up a scenario that tells us what this story is about. This story is about a woman who was, it was very clear to her that she was broken and hurting. It was very clear that she was an outcast, in exile in the community. It was very clear that she was in desperate need of change, of healing, of transformation, of the pieces of her life being put back together, of the hope that tomorrow might actually be better than today, that she's not just trapped in an endless cycle of shame and guilt and mistakes and what they said and what they did, that somehow that could be broken out of. And what I find so powerful is that Jesus says something. I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven as her great love has shown. He doesn't say, now that she's performed this ritual, she's fine. Jesus says it's out of her profound sense of God's love and forgiveness that are already hers that she does this. She comes and extravagantly gives herself away. And the Pharisee doesn't, Jesus isn't saying that Simon the Pharisee doesn't have a lot of stuff he needs help with. He's not saying he doesn't need forgiveness. He's not saying that he's not broken too. What Jesus is saying is that this woman is aware of her need and Simon isn't aware of his. And that's why when this story comes to a close, one person leaves with peace and the other is still stuck, keeping up a facade, keeping up a mask, keeping up this false face that says everything's great. I think what this story profoundly points out to us is I think it points out something that we are really, really good at. And that is we're really, really good at pretending like we're not hurt. We've been betrayed. We've been wounded. We've had something handed to us. And the mature thing we believe, the tough thing, the macho thing, is to just not talk about it, to pretend like everything's fine, that nobody can hurt us. We're 10 feet tall and bulletproof. There's no way that their words or what they've done can hurt us. And you know, when you hear something about yourself, that maybe you've heard something about yourself spoken by somebody else that wasn't even true. And what you desperately want to say is that says a lot more about them than it does about me. Right? And we'll say things like, well, at least they're not talking about somebody who can't handle it. But the reality is, we're carrying that somewhere. We're carrying that pain somewhere. It doesn't just go away. And I think we typically have a few responses. We repress our pain. We try just to ignore it and stuff it back. We just keep it away. Keep it in an arm's distance. Don't think about it. Don't deal with it. And time goes by. And we think, oh, time will heal all wounds. But time doesn't heal everything, does it? And you'll find that something that happened 30 years ago that you've been kind of stuffing in the keeping under the rug, now it comes out and you actually have to deal with it. And the pain is greater and the bitterness is greater and the anger is greater. Everything is magnified because you've been ignoring it and repressing it for so long. And then we also, we repress, we ignore, and we deny. We deny. I can't tell you the number of times I've been with people who have undergone great loss and their first response is, oh, but I'm so happy for them, so fine. And there's a certain truth to that in the sense that in the Christian tradition, we don't grieve like people without hope. We entrust that the tomb is empty, and so we entrust ourselves to Christ in that way, and it's beautiful. But no matter how much joy you can have in that, there's still pain. There's still grief. We can't ignore it. We can't deny it. When they said what they said and it hurt you, it doesn't make you a stronger person to pretend like it didn't hurt you. When that event happened that changed your life forever, and you want to pretend like it didn't hurt, it did. And until you own the hurt that happened, you'll never begin to move toward healing. That's the story. This is the two images we get. We get this woman who knows her story and her brokenness, and this guy, Simon, who's completely denying that he even has a problem. I think we live in a culture where we've lost the ability to lament. You know what a lament is? It's songs, psalms. Lots of the psalms are laments. We'll look at part of one here in a second. But a lament is essentially, there's a whole book in the Bible, by the way, called Lamentations. How many of you ever read Lamentations? If you're ever having a really good day and you just want to be brought back to reality, read Lamentations, because it is there's like two verses that are kind of hopeful, and the rest of it's kind of like, wah, wah, Debbie Downer. You know what I mean? It's just a downer. And that's in the biblical tradition. People who realize that pain can't just be ignored and repressed. We have to somehow get it out. We have to talk about it. We have to relate it somehow. Notice this psalm, Psalm 32. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. When I kept silent, it was like my bones were wasting away. How many of you have been there? Anybody? You've been carrying it around, trying to stuff it, repress it, deny it, ignore it, and your pain didn't go away, but it actually began to affect, because it wasn't just like we talk about being physically sick, and then there's a soul kind of sickness. There's a soul pain that a Band-Aid or a splint won't take care of. There's something deeper. And when we repress it, ignore it, and deny it, we fail to find the path toward healing. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away. When I was in seminary, we were given two advisors in the school. One was an academic advisor who tried to assure us that after lots and lots of money, we would probably graduate. The other one was a spiritual advisor. And I thought that was kind of interesting. You had to make an appointment to have a, because I was a commuter student, so you had to make an appointment to have a phone call every so often with your spiritual advisor. And it was the day he was going to call me, like, you know those mornings when everything just falls apart and you can't get the coffee made fast enough? And it was, you know, this is the day he's supposed to call me. And so I'm really wound up and worked up, and I'm just thinking, I got to get through this as quick as possible, and I'm fine anyway. And so he calls me, and he starts asking me all these questions about how I'm doing and how my soul is and how my heart is. I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. You know, just giving him all the right answers. You know, it's what you're supposed to do, right? So, how you doing? Oh, I'm doing great. And man, I just, you know, God's just like close to me as a brother. You know, you just say all this. And he keeps asking questions. I'm like, dude, let me off the phone. I've got to get my coffee. I've got to get to work. I got stuff to do. And he just keeps asking questions. And I'm getting more and more agitated as he asks me more and more questions. I'm thinking, hey, you know those people who they can't take a hint? This guy's one of them. He can't take a hint. I need to get out of here. And then I begin to realize, the more he asks, he's like, is there anybody that you have an unresolved issue with and it's causing you pain? No. And then it hit me that part of the reason I was so angry with him was because I had an issue with somebody that was unresolved and I didn't want to deal with it. And it was a person who had hurt me multiple times, and I had trouble, I was just trying to forgive and forget and move on. And, you know, I mean, I'm a pastor. I get up and talk to people about forgiveness all the time, so I should be an expert at this. And what I found is that for a couple of years, I'd been carrying around this grudge that had went from just a simple dislike to maybe a contempt, and it was teetering on the edge of just absolute hatred. And so he and I had this conversation, and the more we talked about it, the more free I began to feel, because it was no longer just my thing to carry around. It was his thing too. And before we got off the phone, he had prayer with me. Has anybody ever prayed with you on the phone? It's kind of weird at first when they start praying. You're like, are you talking to me now? Because you can't see them. And he said, he prays for me over the phone. We get off the phone, and I begin to realize I've been carrying this around, and it's not been hurting this person. It's been hurting this person. It's been hurting me. And I desperately need to enter into that journey of not carrying this by myself, but allowing somebody else to journey with me, carry it with me. When I keep silent, my bones waste away. In Revelation 3, the writer, John, Jesus, he's speaking for Jesus here, and he's writing to these seven churches in Asia, and to one in Laodicea, he says, you say, I'm rich, I have acquired wealth, and do not need a thing, but you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. You see yourselves one way, but really you're another. You put on a false front, and you begin to even believe yourself that there's no issue. And what time and what honesty will reveal is that you actually have more desperate need than you ever possibly imagined. I think one of the powerful things in this story is that this woman, she comes to Jesus and she has no pretense. She's not denying anything. She just comes to Jesus in her brokenness and in her pain and in all the agony she's been living in. And she finds something freeing that sets her on a journey. I'm not one of those people who believes, like, at the end of this service, we're going to say this magic prayer, and your entire life's going to be perfect, and you're going to walk outside, and little bluebirds are going to swoop down on you. I don't think that's how it works. I firmly believe transformation is a journey. I don't think you're just going to pray about this, and it's going to, you know, be perfect. But I think what this woman began in that moment was this journey. A journey toward learning to see herself differently, a journey toward a journey of wholeness and healing, a journey away from the things that had previously defined her into something new. And what made that possible, and we're going to look more about that identity issue next week, but what made that possible is that she was open and honest, not only with herself, but with Jesus. And actually became that entire room of people. And when this was no longer her thing to carry, it got a bit lighter. When one of the things I learned about maturity is when we were in the Dominican this summer, we had these big, massive rocks that we had to move in. It took four of us guys to move one of them. It took several of it. You know, we had to get on these big rocks two by two because they were so heavy. And 10, 15 years ago, you know what I would have done? I would have charged in and tried to pick them all up by myself. Because there's something about being able to carry a big rock that says, I am a man. Right? I mean, that's how you define manliness. It's I'm carrying a bigger rock than the other guy. And what, you know, and you can call it laziness, but I realized this time I have no desire to try to pick that up by myself. Like if it was this big, hey, somebody grab the side of this. Let's do this together. It's easier together. And what I've learned is that what's true of moving heavy stuff is also true of carrying heavy things, like in the soul area. It's when we're willing to say to somebody else, hey, come alongside me because this is too much for me to handle on my own. One point in Galatians chapter 6, I think, Paul says, bear one another's burden. It's this invitation. Do not go through life alone. Do not go through life carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders when you have brothers and sisters all around you who want to carry that weight with you. One of the reasons we continually invite you to small groups, we continually do, and it's because we were not made to do this alone. Now, I don't doubt that you can sit at home and get a blessing and you don't have to be around other people and you can be spiritual and that's fantastic. But the spiritual life that Jesus leaves us is not one lived in isolation from other people. It is one lived in community and in shared burden. It's a journey that we come alongside one another, we pick up the load, and we help each other carry it forward. And at times we help each other leave it behind because we begin to realize there are some things we're carrying we don't need to be carrying in the future. My past does not have to determine my future. Tomorrow does not have to be an endless loop of today and yesterday, again, again, and again. What Jesus offers us is a brand new day, a brand new tomorrow. Jesus invites us into a journey where what happened to us and what they said about us and all the things that have gone on to bring us pain, those things do not have the final word, but Jesus has the final word. And his word to this woman when she leaves is peace. Peace. And peace is possible for her simply because she's willing to own up to all the ways she desperately needs it and can't manufacture it on her own. Jesus restores her to the community, by the way. When he forgives her publicly, do you know why he does this? Because he wants to say to everybody else in the room, she's good. Do not alienate her. Do not cast her out. She's no longer on the outside looking in. She is one of us. She's your brother. She's your sister. She's not your brother. She's your sister, but get the point. He restores her to right relationship with everybody else. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away. I wonder how many of us, maybe through pride, maybe we've just been taught that what real strong, mature people do is to just suck it up and keep moving forward and don't talk about it. But whether it happened 30 years ago or 3 minutes ago, if you don't deal with it at some point, it's going to become a really huge thing. And it's going to start straining your other relationships. It's going to start making all of your relationships difficult. It's going to start making all of your interaction difficult. So maybe we should end today with just this question. What do I need to be honest about? And we're not going to like set a microphone up here and have you come up and spill everything. But maybe in this moment, maybe we just take a moment and be honest with God and say, listen, I've got this person who I almost hate, or this person I'm harboring a grudge against. I got this person I need to forgive. I got this situation that won't let me go. I've got these mistakes that are haunting me. I've got all this stuff I'm carrying around on my shoulders. And what I desperately need is somebody to come alongside me and lift that load. And it may be that you don't have anybody in your life right now you trust deeply enough to open up to them, but it may be that you reach out to others through things like small groups and build some relationships, and you find one of the things that always blows me away about a small group is you're in this room with people who at first were just mere acquaintances, maybe not even that, and before long, you have a whole group of people who are carrying that burden with you, and it's beautiful. So what do we need to be honest about? Is there someone, is there something, some situation that we just need to begin to speak it? That we need to begin to be honest about it. And maybe if we can begin this morning to just say in our own maybe heart and mind and soul to God, this person, this situation, this pain, this hurt. Maybe if we begin to speak that to him, maybe that'll be the first step on a journey toward wholeness, where what happened then does not determine who we become, and where all the ways we've been betrayed and hurt and left, all those things don't determine the people we become in the future. So let's just bow our heads for a moment, and I'm going to just give us a moment of silence. Maybe in this moment, you just begin right there in your own heart and on your own soul. Communicate to God what it is and who it is that needs to be spoken. Father, as we're all naming people and situations hurt, may we realize that you are a safe place. We can bring these things, and that you can do more with it than we can on. I pray for my friends, my brothers and sisters, maybe who've been carrying around pain for a long, long time. It just doesn't seem to be light at the end. I pray for my brothers and sisters who aren't, at this point, haven't been willing to name it, be honest about it. Help us to do that, because it's in the naming of it and being honest about it that healing becomes possible, that the journey toward wholeness becomes a real possibility for us. Father, we lift up to you these names, these situations, these circumstances, this pain, this hurt, guilt, the shame, all of it. We entrust it to the one who said that when we're burdened and heavy laden, when we're worn out, when we have nowhere else to turn, that we can unload on you. And as we sit in this room with brothers and sisters, maybe some we know, some we don't, may we realize that what makes the church such a powerful force for good in the world is that we're not on our own, but that we're brothers and sisters, shared journey, helping one another carry these heavy loads. God, for those of us in isolation, may you draw us out into meaningful relationships. May you take all of our excuses for why that won't work. We don't have time. We don't have. May we take all those excuses, move them to the side, and just give healing and hope. God, we're grateful that our pain and suffering do not have the final word, that our mistakes and ways we've messed up don't have the final word, but your word, peace, your final word, love, your final word. And so we rest in that reality today. Rest in the truth that we are loved, not once we straighten up, but we are loved and accepted by you right here, right now, as we are. Father, help us speak honestly with you and maybe a brother or sister who we come in contact with about what's going on with us so that we can begin this journey of healing. We're grateful for this moment. We're grateful for the story. It continually invites us to a deeper level of connection. We have all these things. Strong healing name. Everybody said.